This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
On the 114th day of the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, the death toll soars past 26,400, mostly women and children. The U.N. Secretary General urges governments to sustain contributions to UNRWA, highlighting the critical support needed for nearly 2 million civilians in the besieged Gaza Strip. And in a significant scientific achievement, Iran successfully launches 3 domestically manufactured satellites into orbit. Thanks for joining us. More deaths and destruction in the Gaza Strip as Israel bombs nearly 24 locations 114 days into its onslaught on the territory. The regime has killed 165 Palestinians, injuring 290 others in 24 hours. The death toll from the nearly four-month genocide now stands at 26,422, most of them children and women. Meanwhile, the Gaza Media Office says the regime has killed 120 reporters in the coastal strip since the aggression began. Israel's indiscriminate bombings have also destroyed much of the Gaza Strip and its infrastructure, including hospitals. Doctors Without Borders say that Gaza no longer has a functioning healthcare system. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Moti Abu Musaba, for more details about the situation there.
It's the 114th consecutive day of this continuous Israeli aggression targeting Gaza Strip, and the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli attacks are still maintained, hitting all areas of Gaza Strip, despite that those attacks actually are intensified in Khan Yunis city particularly. However, last night was harsh for the Palestinian civilians inside Gaza City, as the Israeli warplanes maintained their attacks and their airstrikes against several residential buildings in the western parts of Gaza City and even the southern parts of Gaza City, and even in the northern part of Gaza Strip and Beit Lahia City. The Israeli artillery actually continued its attacks and its shelling. It's worth mentioning that according to Gaza's health ministry, that the number of the Palestinian civilians killed yesterday over the last night reached 165 Palestinian civilians in 19 horrible massacres committed by the Israeli occupation forces, where the injuries actually hit 290 Palestinians. And so this kind of the continuous targeting and the continuous shelling actually took the number of the Palestinian civilians who have been killed since the beginning of this onslaught so far to 26,422 Palestinian civilians, in addition to 5,087 injuries.
The UN chief has called on the Western governments that have suspended funding for UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees to at least guarantee the continuity of its operations. Antonio Guterres said 2 million civilians in Gaza depend on critical aid from UNRWA for daily survival. He added that the agency's current funding will not allow it to meet all the requirements to support them in February. The UNRWA chief has also slammed the aid cuts as shocking. Several countries, including the U.S. and U.K., have suspended donations to UNRWA following Israeli allegations that some of the agency's staff were involved in Hamas' October 7 operation. The Palestinian Resistance Movement has called on the U.N. and other international organizations not to cave into Israeli threats and blackmail. Gilbert Doctorow is an independent international affairs analyst who joins us from Brussels. Welcome to the program. So when you take a look at this, it's really quite shocking. I guess one way of describing it is what has been said, that it's a collective punishment for the Palestinians. But for Israel to do that, and then for the U.S. and the U.K. to follow at this current juncture, is another blow to the fate of Palestinians, for lack of a better way of saying it. What is your impression of what has occurred here?
What has occurred here is called distraction. It is an intentional move by Israel, by the United States, by the UK, to direct world news away from the ongoing atrocities that Israel is perpetrating in Gaza to a side issue where they can put the United Nations and the world community on a back foot. I think it is reasonable to assume that there were several culpable members of the UNRWA team operating in Gaza. There are several thousand people on the payroll of the United Nations organization to provide this assistance, and it is not shocking that among several thousand people there would be a handful of what Americans call bad apples. However, as I say, let us not be subscribers to the American-Israeli attempt at distraction from the real issues of the day. The real issues of the day are the ongoing atrocities, which you have just reported in your latest news bulletin, with 165 civilians murdered by the Israeli forces. This is a real issue of the day. And the I think that at this particular moment, we have to bear in mind the ICJ ruling of late last week, which puts in a frame of international judicial expertise the quality of Israeli action in Gaza and calls it by its proper name, genocide. We are at a crucial moment this weekend. There are three anniversaries that are being celebrated in the last 3 days, and these are the anniversary of the original Holocaust, with a capital H, the genocide perpetrated by Nazi Germany against the Jewish population of Europe. That is one anniversary. The another anniversary is the lifting of the blockade of Leningrad, which had been put in effect by Germany, and had the essence of genocide as its intent, killing more than a million civilians in that city. And these two, just all by themselves, remind us that it is utterly shocking that the state of Israel is trampling on the notion of the Holocaust and using it to justify its perpetrating the same kind of destruction against an innocent people as it had experienced, as the Hebrew nation had experienced at the hands of Germany in the run-up and during World War II. This is what should be on the front pages of the news, not the misdeeds of a handful of people in an organization that is saving thousands of lives in Gaza.
Well, I was going to say, first of all, thank you for the points that you made there. In terms of what, however, that's occurred in this case with UNRWA, it appears that there is this maximum almost a chokehold that Israel, with the cooperation of the U.S., that they want to exert on the Palestinians with the ultimate aim of wanting to push out and uproot them from the Gaza Strip so they can go wherever perhaps that they have in mind, the U.S. and Israel, that is, maybe Egypt or Jordan. Do you think that is one of the aims, so they show no signs of relief for the Palestinians whatsoever? When we take a look at the bombings, people waiting up, for example, waiting in a line, queuing up for food, and then getting murdered that way. I mean, these are all signs that they just don't want these Palestinians to stay in the Gaza Strip. Do you see it that way?
The malicious intent of the Netanyahu government, which is exemplified by the conduct of the prime minister himself and a couple of right extremist members of his cabinet, who alone assured the viability of his alliance and hold on power. This is the essence of the situation. And it is very sad that Israel seems to be unable to rid itself of these criminals who are called its government. The Israeli population, by latest polls, largely supports the violence against the Gaza people. That, so to look for a salvation within Israel, I think, is a big mistake. However, the ruling of the International Court of Justice brings into play a whole different set of calculations. The enabler of the Israeli genocide is the United States. The possibility in future months that charges will be brought against the Biden administration for its active support of the genocidal acts of Israel, that is the big determining factor in the way things go forward. Mr. Biden is, shall we say, standing at the edge of his grave, and what happens in a year or two cannot be of great importance to this fragile mind of Mr. Biden. However, he has supporters and assistants who are 30 years, 40 years younger than he, and who will be, if law goes according to the proper course, they will be facing criminal charges in what could be a Nuremberg type of accounting for the Israeli atrocities and for its enablers. At the very least, America being very much driven by legal actions, by court actions, there is the possibility of many civil actions across the United States against the Biden and his advisors. And this threat will inevitably, sooner or later, hopefully sooner, compel the United States to withdraw its support for Israel and to put a firm end to the genocidal policies we see today.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Moving on, the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released new footage of its attacks on Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip. In the latest operations, Al-Qassam said that it targeted an Israeli tank and a troop carrier with rocket-propelled grenades in the west of Khan Yunis. The Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, said that it attacked Israeli military vehicles around Khan Yunis as well. Al-Quds also fired rockets and mortars targeting Israeli forces in the Al-Maghazi camp. The group has fired missiles at several Israeli towns, including Sderot as well. Earlier we talked to Canadian author and journalist Eric Wahlberg. He says Israel wants everything in West Asia region to go up in flames.
The U.S. is allowing this to happen. It's basically saying, go crazy. We don't mind. So we really have to look to the U.S. because Israel is not responsible. It's not a state. It's not a viable state that respects international borders or international laws of any kind. So we really are stuck with the U.S. unless, if Turkey or some tried to go in and provide relief, they would just be bombed by Israel. Israel would like that because Israel wants a regional war. It wants everything to go up in flames. And it just assumes that it will be the survivor, and it will then have, full reign. It's not stopping at all. And the ICJ, I hope the judges are watching. They should have been watching for the last 100 days. I don't know why they, again, it's the U.S. If the ICJ had come out and said, this is genocide, you've got to stop, that all hell would break loose with the U.S. Being the shaitan here. So I really don't know what we can do. The Palestinians have to struggle, they have to endure, but Israel is ready to kill them all.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has used a new tactical missile in its latest operations against Israel's military sites. Footage released by the movement shows Falak 1 missiles fired at Israel's Ma'ale Golani barracks on Friday. The new projectile has a range of 10 kilometers and carries a highly explosive warhead weighing 50 kilograms. Falak 1 missiles have a caliber of 240 millimeters. Hezbollah has also used another new weapon in its operations against the regime. It fired a top attack anti-tank guided missile in an assault on an Israeli military outpost. The movement released a video depicting the missile's launch, its rapid ascent, and its trajectory toward the outpost on a cliffside along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has been attacking Israeli military sites since October 7. On Saturday, it staged seven more anti-Israeli operations. In one of them, Hezbollah used Falak 1 missiles to hit a secret command center in the Zabdin barracks at the Israeli-occupied Sheba Farms. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Salah says that Hezbollah had a pretty busy day on Saturday as it carried out several operations against the IOF, targeting Israeli soldiers and military bases.
Well, it was a pretty busy day today for the Lebanese resistance. They had several operations against Israeli posts, the most significant of which was the one where they targeted the Zabdin barracks in the occupied Sheba Farms using the Falak 1. Now, this is just a rocket that was debuted just yesterday by Hezbollah's resistance since the beginning of the confrontations. This is the first time that they uncover the use of Falak 1, which is, of course, something that was developed by Iran's aerospace industries organization. And it is, of course, known to have a range of 10 kilometers and a 50-kilogram warhead. So therefore, that use in itself is very significant. And they understand that the Israelis have said that this is something that would allow Hezbollah to hit their targets precisely on a longer range, and in addition to inflict more heavy casualties for the Israelis when it comes to against their soldiers or the barracks itself. And the fact that Hezbollah has also been able to know and detect the exact whereabouts of this secret headquarters, as they said, is also in itself very significant when it comes to the intelligence war between Hezbollah and Israel.
The Israeli military has launched a fresh incursion into the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Details from the operation are sketchy, but there are reports that the regime has deployed special forces and snipers near the Jenin refugee camp. The reports say that resistance fighters have engaged the intruding forces in armed clashes in Al-Hadaf neighborhood of the city. The Israeli military has launched dozens of deadly raids into Jenin since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on October 7. That is part of a wider campaign of raids in the West Bank that has killed over 370 and injured 4,300 others. A correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us with more details about the Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp.
News coming from the refugee camp revealed that the Palestinians in the refugee camp discovered the undercover unit in the Al-Hadaf neighborhood in Jenin refugee camp. And this means that Israeli forces were there and they raided the refugee camp of Jenin and the city of Jenin. The clashes are taking place and the operation is still going on. Why? In the first place, the Israeli undercover unit raided the Jenin refugee camp. It is still unknown. The Israeli military didn't issue any statements yet, but the operation is still going on, and all the entrances to the refugee camp had been closed, where Israeli forces are stationing at the entrances to the Jenin refugee camp, as well as in the city of Jenin. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces had raided the city of Nablus and the village of Beita in Nablus. At least five Palestinians had been detained. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli forces had raided Qabatia as well in Jenin, and clashes had erupted between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces. In the village of Ashyuch in Al Khalil, Israeli forces have stormed the village of Ashyuch, and at least five Palestinians had been detained there, where the Israeli forces stormed Palestinians' homes and destroyed the belongings of the Palestinians. In the Betonia village near Ramallah, Israeli forces had arrested two brothers there. And in Qalqibi, a number of Palestinians had been detained, including one woman.
And that does it for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Aperture. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
You clear there and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protected clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward. The worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt, and it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, well, me too. But...
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze, well, you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in the stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, OK.
About there? Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole and they crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on. Digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Kills the entire weed, roots and all.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Right.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 24D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 24D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 24D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 24D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
24D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D.
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I would have to... I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides, and that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas. And it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products. What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he's constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
The cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking out from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals and the environment. It's yet to finish that review. Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995 but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
it is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believe this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثتو لأتمم مکارم الاخلاق.
The Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of For a Better Life. Don't forget that we are Arab English Radio and I'm Bita. And once again, I have the opportunity to be next to you in order to analyze and talk about different things and different points of human beings in order to have a better life. In this episode, we're going to face a complete and important question, a revolutionary time of your life. When was it? When was the time that you first come to this point that, oh my gosh, I need to change everything. I need to change myself. I need to change the way I'm living, the way I'm using my time, the way I'm wasting my time, and the way I'm communicating with Allah Almighty. There are times, specifically the bad times that you are experiencing. Most of the people, when they got into troubles, when they lose some beloved person, in these kind of situations, they will find back their faith and they will be like, oh my gosh, Allah, please help us. And this is not a true faith, by the way, because this faith is only triggered by the difficulties and obstacles of the time. So, as we know, death takes people suddenly. So we must leave asking ourselves, am I ready to answer to Allah? If not, today is a time to change. It's a revolution for your soul and a revolution for every single one that is listening to us. In order to get changed, in order to have a revolutionary moment with yourself, to pave the way of humanity and being a good servant for Allah Almighty. In the entire history of humanity, nothing has ever brought change to the world like Islam. And, you know, I can tell you certainly that Islam was a revolution throughout the history, which actually caused a lot of consequences and a lot of important impact on people up until now. So, the message of the final prophet, may peace and blessings be upon him and his family, not only transformed the whole civilization, but the whole world and the whole history. Even today, Islam stands out in its capacity to drive its followers to pursue worship, purity, and generosity in a world full of capitalism and destruction. So, dear listeners, let's go for a short break. Stay tuned.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Love is all I need.
All I need.
Love is all I need.
Oh, oh, oh,
your love is all I need. To be all I need. And I know that you see how much you mean to me. You mean to me, 'cause your love is all I need to be all I can be. And I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program For a Better Life. In the first part of our episode, I talked about this revolutionary times that we may go through during our life, that we feel like we have to change everything. And we mentioned this important point that Islam was a revolution throughout the history, not only for the civilization of that time, but also for all the people around the world at all times. We are not the first generation to be tempted by greed and pleasure. We are not the people that feel the darkness and the greed inside our souls. So, in fact, these troubles go back as far as Adam and Eve, peace be upon them, were existed. However, Islam enables its followers to break free from sinful temptation and to pursue a life of serving Allah, our Creator. But the times that we come to ourselves, the times that we feel like we have to do something in order to go through the road that Allah Almighty has put us to be a better human being and a better version of ourselves, is the revolutionary time that I'm talking about. What is it about Islam that enables this and enables this power in its followers in order to change their daily life into a positive change in themselves and find the right path. So, dear listeners, we need to go for a short break in order to get refreshed. Then we're going to come back in a blink of an eye. Stay tuned. Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIP English Radio. You're listening to the program For a Better Life. The key point I mentioned was that you cannot change yourself without believing that you need to get changed. And this is really important, of course. And this is exactly the revolutionary times that I'm talking about. The times that you feel the need to be changed. So, as we raise our own faith and iman, our good deeds flow more naturally from our hands. With Allah's permission, our good deeds will become solely for His sake. And it is these deeds which will bring us closer to Jannah. Allah recognizes that humans have a love for this world, but that the true believers are those whose worldly temptation is overcome by fear of the Day of Judgment and Resurrection. These believers focus their lives and deeds for pleasing Allah Almighty, rather than seeking to gain the respect of His creation. And this is the true inner revolution that everyone needs in order to take the first step of being a better human being. One of the most beautiful sentences I've read up to here from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, which is, one of the blessings of this revolution has been the spiritual transformation observed in our society. I have repeatedly said that this spiritual transformation witnessed in Iran, brought about by this revolution with the will of God, the most exalted, the most high, has been more valuable and more important than the victory we have achieved or the fact that we have curtailed the hands of the foreigners and criminals from this country. Actually, this beautiful sentence will remind us about the inner revolutions and inner changes that we go through, and more importantly, about the fact that human beings have this potential capacity to get changed, to go and develop, to reach the level of perfection. So, self-making and attaining to the highest level of perfection have ever been the final objectives of every human being, knowingly or unknowingly. Nevertheless, this is not an easy task, as it requires, first of all, that one should recognize oneself, improve one's abilities, and then advance towards the set objectives. So, guiding people to achieve this great objective has been the obligation undertaken by the divine prophets and godly reformers. So, as we all know, man becomes the subject of various branches of science from different aspects, like psychology, sociology, history, ethics, medicine, and even physiology and biology are branches of science which deal with man from a specific point of view. So, in this episode, we're going to discuss man from the viewpoint that he's a being who can undergo perfection. We will deal with the ultimate form of perfection and the way it can be reached. So, we will endeavor to recognize the way to reap more and better benefit from internal abilities and external facilities to reach perfection and true prosperity by means of reflecting in our own being and finding elements in our nature which are established to lead to and fulfill the main objectives and recognizing inclinations existing for sublime human causes as well as relations which tie us with one another and enable us to make ourselves more powerful and prepared for progress and development by using them and striving to solidify and strengthen them. You cannot change yourself before believing in the change that you're going to make. There are times that you feel like you have to change your deeds into the better one. Thank you for listening to me. It was all the time I had for today's episode. May Allah bless all of us and put us in the right path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every every shade of palm, every closed hand in us, every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us, every thought I had and every word I share.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.